Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. I wanted to start by highlighting my ignorance when I made up the title of this presentation. I said to CBD Solutions that we'd call it Cut Me and I'll Bleed because we were talking obviously about coagulopathy. That is not very accurate. Title I should have given the presentation is If You Prick Us, Do We Not Bleed? And I think that's what I was kind of thinking about, but clearly I don't remember much about my higher English. That is a quote taken directly from The Merchant of Venice. It's a Shakespeare quote, and the whole lot of it is, if you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? So I just wanted to update and correct myself to start with. So we are talking today about coagulation disorders in small animals, and I wanted to start by just thinking about a couple of key questions for any bleeding disorder. I think we have to think fundamentally, is the do disorder to do with primary hemostasis, to do with secondary hemostasis, or to do with both elements of coagulation? And we'll go on to talk a little bit more about these in a little bit more detail. I don't want to dwell too much on the complexities of coagulation. The coagulation model is extremely complex, and involves, as we've said, this primary and secondary part. The diagrams here are inside blood vessels. A lot of the initial activation of coagulation comes when the blood vessel wall is disturbed, and the whole platelet clot or platelet plug mechanism kicks into play. This is an electron micrograph of a part of a clot, and I just think it really displays really well the complexities of coagulation. It's quite a nice image to look at as well. This cell-based model of coagulation involves multiple different factors, as you can see here, and these three components of initiation, amplification, and propagation. Again, we're not going to delve into this in too much detail. I think it's something that you learn for boring exams, but maybe don't need as much of this information for the clinical side of things. We'll kind of tap into what is more clinically applicable. I don't want to teach you things that you already know, but I think it's really important to cover some of the basic things because actually a lot of the issues we have around coagulation disorders and interpreting results can be to do with the way that samples have been taken. We must make sure that we select the right tube, and for coagulation times, normally that's sodium citrate. Often that will be a purple tube, but it can sometimes be green, so just be aware of that. Make sure the tube is filled appropriately. That goes for any tube that contains an anticoagulant. You want to make sure that the tube has been appropriately filled because that can certainly alter the interpretation of your results. Venipuncture is really important. If, as I've just said, part of the coagulation process starts the minute a blood vessel has been damaged. And if you're sticking the jugular 20 times through both sides of it, then you will be activating the coagulation cascade. And therefore, we like to take coagulation samples from a clean stick. Make sure the samples are stored appropriately. And by that, I mean making sure that, for instance, for individual clotting factors that go off normally to the Animal Health Trust, that needs to be often a citrated sodium citrated plasma sample. So you put it in sodium citrate, you spin the sample so that there's plasma there. That plasma needs to be removed and frozen. Bit of a faff, but really important for the analysis of individual factors. Try not to delay processing too much. So we don't want to be taking these samples, putting them in the fridge, and then processing them a week later. I think with any coagulation parameters that you're measuring, my absolute top advice would be that you want to ask the lab if there's any doubt. Phone the lab and say, we want to run this test. What exact sample do you need? just showing you here. So ultimately, for primary coagulation, you're looking at platelets. We'll talk about that a bit more. And that needs to be from an EDTA tube. For secondary coagulation, you are looking at sodium citrate. And those are an example of some of the typical purple sodium citrate tubes. So, how does bleeding present to us? And is the bleeding relevant or not? So, this poor dog hit by a car, the car smashes its face, the dog bleeds from its nose and mouth. That bleeding is completely appropriate in that scenario. And in this situation, the bleeding stopped and we had no concern over a coagulopathy. We were aware, obviously, the dog had been forcibly hit by a car. But that's not always the case. You know, sometimes dogs will present with a minimal amount of trauma that really should not induce continuous bleeding. And in those cases, we have to be thinking about possible coagulopathies. So the typical things that we will see in clinical examination, and sometimes these things, rather surprisingly actually, are identified as incidental findings. So typically we'll see petechiation, which are these small pinpoint type bruises, which we can see on the gums of this dog. And this was actually found, as I said, as a completely incidental finding, and sometimes that will be the case. Petechiation is normally seen on the gums like this, but can also be seen in areas like the sclera. We then talk about ecchymosis, which are really these larger bruised areas. Typically, these are found on the ventral skin of the abdomen, but can be found in other locations. So just a little bit about this pathophysiology. Blood vessels are lined by endothelial cells. This is a barrier, clearly, to prevent red blood cells leaking out of the circulation. If you get any sort of vascular injury, that subendothelial matrix is exposed, and that's where these platelets are going to start adhering to. Now, this mechanism is happening literally every single day, every single second. You know, as I'm sitting here presenting this to you just now, you know, if I'm brushing my hands against the corners of the table, or you know, my leg brushes against the table, I'm not bruising while that's happening. You know, every time my skin is pressed, then potentially there's some squashing or damage to the blood vessels, but I'm not having bruising develop inappropriately because some of these mechanisms are in place. So this is what prevents us literally going around like bruised messes. So I know, again, I'm teaching you things I'm sure you absolutely already know, but I just wanted to highlight the way platelets look under a blood smear. So we can see in this diagram here, I'll just bring this green arrow towards this platelet here. And then you can see another platelet here, and actually there's one here, and then one here. And you can see in that scenario that they are smaller than red blood cells, and they have this kind of slightly irregular appearance, and they can be a little bit of variety between the platelets in the way that they look. But that's the kind of structure that we're expecting to see. So with petechiation and an ecchymosis, those sorts of bruising or inappropriate bleeding will normally happen because of an abnormality with platelets or with the blood vessel itself. So these are little leaks of blood out of the blood vessels. It can be indicative of a more global bleeding problem, but we normally consider petechiation and ecchymosis as a problem with primary coagulation, and by that we mean platelets. And therefore, thrombocytopenia or a low platelet count is usually the most common cause. So, with primary hemostatic disorders, as we said, so disorders of platelets, surface bleeding is the hallmark of this, so the petechiation or ecchymosis that we've seen. You can see other types of bleeding, so notably epistaxis. You can see mucosal surface bleeding. That bleeding can happen on in the brain and the lungs, and obviously that's more severe. True sort of cavity bleeding, so abdominal cavity bleeding or thoracic cavity bleeding, truly is more common with secondary hemostasis. But it can happen with primary hemostatic disorders. A lot of, excuse me, a lot of primary hemostatic disorders can be detected sometimes during routine operations when the animal is quite young. So if there's any sort of congenital platelet disorder, you may find excessive bleeding following surgery or trauma. So it may not become evident until there's a traumatic or surgical event. And this is the kind of thing, I mean, these cases are so frustrating, aren't they? These any cases of epistaxis, regardless of what the cause, getting a lot of the time getting that bleeding under control can be super, super challenging. One of the most common reasons for platelet numbers to be low would be to do with immune-mediated disease. So actually, primary immune-mediated thrombocytopenia is the most common reason for primary hemostatic disorders. So, as a primary process, antibodies are binding to the platelet surface, causing inappropriate destruction, and we consider this to be idiopathic autoimmune disorder. So that's when there is no The platelets are being affected, the number is being reduced, but there isn't an obvious underlying cause for this, so we consider it to be an idiopathic autoimmune disorder. On the other hand, we can get this secondary immune-mediated process. So there is still immune-mediated disease here, but there is an underlying cause. There's an underlying antigenic stimulus, and that's most notably drugs, infectious diseases, cancer. A lot of discussion about vaccinations and immune-mediated disease, but actually we fail to find an association with immune-mediated thrombocytopenia. Most notably, drug-wise, drugs like sulfonamides and cephalosporins are very notable in their propensity to cause immune-mediated thrombocytopenia. Anaplasma, Babesia, and Ehrlichia are definitely infectious diseases that can cause immune-mediated thrombocytopenia. In the UK, we're less excited by infectious disease, but there have been cases of anaplasma and actually Babesia in this country, but not as commonly. And then any underlying inflammatory disease has the possibility of causing immune-mediated thrombocytopenia. Thrombocytopenia is a really common abnormality, but it's not always a real abnormality. Some of the major things that you mustn't do is trust your benchtop machine. Your hematology analyzer might not count your platelets appropriately. And if the hematology analyzer is telling you that you've got low platelets, then we must be verifying that. We want to be looking at blood smears and making sure that, first of all, that the analyzer is counting the platelets accurately, but also not ignoring the large platelet clump that would be on the edge of the smear. Because, yes, there are no platelets in the body of the smear, but the reason for that is because they're all clumped together at the end of the smear. So it's really just assessing the accuracy of the machine. If you've had traumatic venipuncture, it may well be you want to take another sample to check accuracy, and definitely, as I said, looking for platelet clumps. And this is an example of a platelet clump in this picture here. So your diagnostic evaluation, you want to do a good clinical exam, and we'll talk a little bit about why that's important. You want to do a platelet count. You want to be verifying that with a blood smear. Thrombocytopenia is rarely the sole cause of bleeding when the platelet count is over 50 times 10 to the 9, or more than 5 platelets per high power field. To be honest, as a rule of thumb, most of these immune-mediated thrombocytopenias, the platelet count is like zilch, so they don't normally mess around in the kind of 2, 3, 4 region or 10, 20, 30 region. They're usually absolutely through the animal's boots. You want to be doing a full hematology and detailed smear examination, but you want to be making sure your physical examination is very detailed, including fundoscopic examination, because you can end up missing things like this. So yes, there might not be evidence of global bleeding, but there could be indeed evidence of retinal bleeding, as in this picture. And also, really interestingly, this has come up quite nicely actually in this image. I've seen more than one case of immune-mediated thrombocytopenia where the animal has presented for sudden onset blindness because of bleeding into the globe. And you can see where I've put the green arrow here that this blood has then settled in this dog's eye. But bleeding into the globe was the major problem that actually spurred the presentation. Bone marrow samples, to be honest, are rarely useful in cases of immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, and you maybe don't want to be doing bone marrow in cases that are spontaneously hemorrhaging anyway. Again, spleen and liver and lymph node FNAs, probably in the early stages of disease, you're going to avoid because you don't want to necessarily be sticking a needle into the spleen of a dog with an ultrasound that has no platelets. Certainly, imaging of the chest and abdomen really important because once you've made a tentative diagnosis of immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, you want to be going on to determine whether this is a primary or secondary problem. You want to know whether there's underlying disease because that might be treatable. The pictorial here is of a 4DX SNAP test. Especially in the UK, I don't think we need to go absolutely crazy looking for infectious diseases, but I do think we have to be mindful of them, and therefore, this is a quick and easy way of doing serological testing for diseases that might be significant. And in the UK, obviously, Lyme's disease and anaplasma are probably the most relevant here. But before you get carried away sending away expensive tick PCR panels, this might be something just to consider. Excuse me. We want to remove the offending underlying problem. So you want to remove the offending drug or underlying disease. Regardless of that, we are still dealing with an immune-mediated process, regardless of whether the problem is primary or secondary. Even if the dog or cat does have a tumor somewhere, you're not going to probably be taking that tumor away straight away. That dog will still need immunosuppressive glucocorticoid therapy. Glucocorticoids are definitely your treatment of choice at immunosuppressive doses, so at least 2 mg per kg per day, if not 2 mg per kg twice a day to start with, which is what I often will do. There are some other drugs that we can consider for immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, and those drugs would notably be vincristine and human intravenous immunoglobulin. Human intravenous immunoglobulin is basically trying to reduce that antibody reaction, and vincristine is stimulating platelet release from the bone marrow. In the studies that have looked at both of these drugs, when they're used concurrently with steroids, both drugs had equally effective results when it came to reducing hospitalization time. The biggest deciding factor between these two is that the human intravenous immunoglobulin is extremely expensive and very difficult to get. Actually, currently, I tried to get this for a patient the other day, and it was nigh on impossible. Vincristine, although a chemotherapeutic agent, is cheaper, as effective, and easier to administer. But I understand there are some limitations with it being a chemotherapeutic drug. We would slowly taper the dose of steroids over 4 to 6 months once the platelet count was normal. So you're waiting for the platelet count to come into the normal range, and then I normally do a 25% reduction every 4 weeks. You may have to consider other immunomodulatory drugs if the steroids alone are not effective. That's less likely to be the case with immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, but certainly not out with the realms of possibility. The drugs we can consider, the evidence base is limited for them, but a drug we're using more and more of is mycophenolate mofetil, normally dosed around 10 milligrams per kilogram every 12 hours. The tablet sizes of this can be a bit awkward. Other options for immunosuppression would be azathioprine or cyclosporine. Giving platelets back in other ways is really challenging. Platelets do not survive transfusion well. So, certainly in products like stored whole blood or packed red blood cells, there are going to be no platelets in there. You may get some benefits of platelets if you're literally taking blood out of one dog as a whole blood transfusion and putting it into the patient. There are platelet replacement products available in the human field. These canine platelet products are still not really available, and even actually in the US, still not commercially available. These platelet concentrate papers show that the products are relatively safe, but the studies kind of supporting the use are still quite limited. But I'm sure in the future this will become more of a potential option. Generally, the prognosis with IMTP is actually quite good. They normally respond really well to steroids. We can often see it concurrently with IMHA, the Evans syndrome that we know about. And it's important to remember that cats also get immune-mediated thrombocytopenia, particularly represented in Maine Coons. Just to think about, if the platelets are not low in number because of immune-mediated destruction, what other things could it be? We see platelet consumption in low numbers in disseminated intravascular coagulation, or DIC, and we can also see it in this kind of concept of hypersplenism. So spleens that are congested or inflammatory or neoplastic may kind of pool platelets. But to be honest, these things are much less common, and I would hope that you would know if your patient had DIC. We can see problems with production from the bone marrow, and this is they're not being destroyed by an immune-mediated process in the circulation. We can see this with infiltrative disorders, so neoplasia of the bone marrow, as well as drug toxicities. A good example of that would be obviously estrogen toxicity, and that's something that we maybe see more commonly in ferrets. Infectious diseases of the bone marrow, endocrine disorders affecting the bone marrow, and hereditary thrombocytopenias. To be quite honest, hereditary thrombocytopenias are super, super, super rare because it is very, very uncommon for an animal that's been born with a thrombocytopenia to survive very long. These are usually patients that will die in and around birth. Just wanted to make you aware of some of the sort of breed quirks. I think most notably on here, greyhounds have lower platelet counts than other dogs, and that is breed related. And Cavalier King Charles Spaniels, along with some other terriers, have macroplatelets. So they have really big platelets that are absolutely miscounted from most hematology analyzers. So, these platelet counts absolutely need to be verified. So if your platelet number is fine, but you think you still have a primary clotting disorder, so the platelets are still not working right, then the likelihood is that, or one of the considerations would be von Willebrand's disease. So von Willebrand's disease is the most common hereditary bleeding disorder in dogs. It's still not massively common. And we would consider this to be a thrombocytopathia. So the platelet number is normal, but their function is not because of various types of disturbance with the concentration of von Willebrand's factor. And there are three types of disorder you have listed here. We can get this type 1 where there's just a general low concentration, type 2 when there is an absence of this high molecular weight multimer, and then the type 3 when there's a complete absence of von Willebrand's factor. As with any primary coagulation disorder, we see mucosal surface bleeding or excessive surgical bleeding if the disease has gone unrecognized. The platelet count will be completely normal. Other coagulation factors such as PT and APTT will be completely normal, and we'll talk about those more. The only way of assessing platelet function, excuse me, when the platelet number is normal is by doing a buccal mucosal bleeding time. When I say the only way, I mean the only way in day-to-day in clinical practice is by doing the buccal mucosal bleeding time. Anything more than 4 minutes to clot formation is abnormal. You can go on and do cool things like measure von Willebrand's factor antigen, but in real time on the day, platelet function can only be assessed by a BMBT. We always use these little standardized guillotines or blades to assess or make the cut in the gum. It's much easier to do this in anesthetized patients because you're kind of lifting up the lip and all that kind of thing. So this can be really challenging when the animals are conscious. There are platelet function analyzers, but they are not readily available. You can definitely measure quantitative von Willebrand's factor assays, as well as doing DNA testing in some breeds. And obviously, the poster child for von Willebrand's disease would be the Doberman. These samples normally have to be sent off to the Animal Health Trust in the UK. So a few interesting treatment options for von Willebrand's disease. So you can use desmopressin. So that's DDAVP or synthetic vasopressin. You can give 1 microgram per kilogram prior to surgery. These animals can benefit from fresh whole blood because that's going to have all your clotting factors and some platelets, and blood in it if they're bleeding. But we can be a little bit more specific about the products we're giving to replace von Willebrand's factor. We can use fresh frozen plasma, but we can actually split that down into its derivative cryoprecipitate that has a higher concentration of von Willebrand's factor in it. And that would be the treatment of choice for known cases. So just to make sure we're all clear about that, so we obviously whole blood is taken as a transfusion. That can be split into packed red blood cells and fresh frozen plasma. The fresh frozen plasma can then be separated into cryoprecipitate and cryopure plasma, so we can further divide. And the cryoprecipitate has a higher concentration of von Willebrand's factor in there. They're partially thawed and then centrifuged again. Okay, so moving on to secondary hemostasis, we talk more specifically about the clotting cascade. And in these cases, we're really talking about, we've done talking about the platelets now, we're talking about clot formation and the factors that are involved. And we see two arms of the clotting cascade. We see the intrinsic and the extrinsic parts, which are highlighted on this diagram here. And we use the benchtop test APTT to measure the intrinsic and the common pathway. And we use PT to measure the extrinsic and the common pathway. And the extrinsic pathway mainly factor 7 focused, whereas the intrinsic we've got 12, 11, 9, and 8. These numbers are actually, as we'll go on to demonstrate, they're not ridiculous things to remember because actually they do help to determine clinically often what's going on. So when we're talking about secondary hemostasis or clot formation, we are talking about these sorts of tests. So we measure prothrombin time or PT, activated partial thromboplastin time or APTT, and these are the most commonly used benchtop tests that you would be seeing. Things like activated clotting time, less commonly used. And we can go on to do things like measure individual factor levels, which we may do if there are abnormalities with PT and APTT to further distinguish a condition. We can also look at things like fibrinogen and D-dimers, and we'll just mention them briefly. So PT, as we saw on the other diagram, measures the extrinsic and common pathways. So the major distinguishing factor here is the ability to measure the effectiveness of factor 7. PT is the time until the formation of the first fibrin strands, if you wanted to know that random fact. But interestingly, a prolonged PT with a normal APTT would indicate factor 7 deficiency, and that is definitely clinically important. APTT is the intrinsic pathway and it measures a few more things, so factors 12, 11, 9, and 8, and obviously the common pathway again. So in this scenario, the reverse is true. A prolongation of APTT with a normal PT would indicate problems with either factors 12, 11, 9, or 8. And 9 and 8 become more interesting because they are the factors that would be affected in cases of hemophilia. Hemophilia C is not really clinically relevant for us, but certainly hemophilia A and hemophilia B are definitely applicable for us, particularly in dogs. Factor 12 deficiency or Hagmann factor deficiency is commonly seen as in cats and may cause a mild prolongation with APTT, but it's not a relevant finding. It's not clinically relevant, but that might just be worth remembering if you're getting mild abnormalities with APTT. I don't work for the Animal Health Trust, but fact is that they do the best job of this. So individual coagulation factors are sent normally to the EHT. Again, the reasons we would be doing this would be because of abnormalities in one of the clotting pathways, particularly. So, in cases where PT was normal, so factor 7 seemed to be working okay, but APTT was prolonged, we might consider running analysis of factors 12, 11, 9, and 8 because that will help distinguish which one of them is abnormal. I would always contact the lab before you do this because they don't always run these factors every day, and again, the sample handling is super important, so you want to make sure you're handling them appropriately. It's less common in practice that you'll measure fibrinogen, but it's important to remember it can be measured. You can get defects of fibrinogen, but less commonly run as a benchtop test. Again, D-dimers, less commonly run benchtop, less commonly run actually as far as assessing coagulation. We often run D-dimers to assess for the likelihood of pulmonary thromboembolism, actually, when it can be massively increased. You can get increased D-dimer concentrations in many different conditions, so slightly more difficult to interpret, but certainly worth considering. And if you're feeling super fancy, you can do TEG, which is thromboelastography, which really is the only way that we have of measuring global coagulation. This is something that can be benchtop. We're lucky to have a TEG machine at the hostel that I work at. It really is only useful, I would say, in developed ICU departments, and would not be something that we would necessarily have on the shelf of every practice, but it's the only way currently we have of measuring global coagulation, which, and by that I mean, every part. So basically, this graph here is showing basically clot formation and degradation, but it's looking at every part of the process. So clinically, vitamin K deficiency is important when we're thinking about coagulopathies. So we most commonly see this with vitamin K antagonism from rat poison. We get decreased vitamin K synthesis from bacterial microflora in some cases of GI disease, but really that's less common. So the most common reason we're going to see this vitamin K deficiency problem is with rat poisons. The vitamin K dependent factors are 2, 7, 9, and 10. That becomes even more interesting when we say that the shortest half-life across those factors is factor 7. So factor 7 has the shortest half-life and it's vitamin K dependent. Therefore, we would see PT rather than APTT becoming disturbed first, usually 2 to 5 days after ingestion, usually around 2 days. Vitamin K is also important for anticoagulant factors, protein C and protein S. So vitamin K needs to be reduced, undergoes this process with vitamin K epoxide reductase. The reason warfarin works as an anticoagulant is because it blocks the vitamin K epoxide reductase process, so you're not getting that reduction of vitamin K into its active form. With vitamin K deficiency, we're going to get things like epistaxis, melena, gingival bleeding, hemoptysis, and hematuria. Excuse me. We can also get dyspnea, coughing, and lethargy because of bleeding into body cavities. We can measure PIVKA, which is proteins induced by vitamin K absence or antagonism, but that's actually less commonly done. And we normally now rely on PT to be coming increased, as I said, 36 to 72 hours after ingestion. APTT will eventually become prolonged, but again, because vitamin K has the shortest half-life, we're going to see PT being disturbed first. In cases of vitamin K deficiency, we want to make them sick, typically with apomorphine. We want to give them something to help with ongoing absorption, so we give them charcoal. We only want to really consider vitamin K supplementation if the clotting parameters are becoming prolonged. So we wouldn't blanket treat patients now with vitamin K from day one for 3 or 4 weeks, as often was cited. We would be suggesting that actually it's much better medicine to have them back at appropriate time points to measure their PT and their APTT. And if the parameters are becoming prolonged, then we would treat them appropriately. I think it's really important to remember the variety of vitamin of rat poisons out there. Not all of them actually are vitamin K antagonists. So it's really important to get the product and understand the product as well. We're signing these dogs up for 2 to 4 weeks of oral therapy. So what we're saying now is, look, that's not necessarily necessary. So doing this or having this situation where you measure the PT and only treat when abnormal is more appropriate. We would always check again after discontinuation of therapy. We can see secondary coagulation problems with other diseases such as liver failure, and again with DIC because clotting factors are being consumed. If you're getting coagulation problems with liver failure, then you're pretty badly affected by your liver failure. So that's pretty end-stage disease. So hemophilia A and B. Hemophilia A is factor 8. Hemophilia B is deficiency in factor 9. This is normally X-linked recessive, with males being affected and females being carriers. A is much more common than B, and inappropriate hemorrhage, usually early on in life, obviously, is a principal clinical sign. The majority of dogs I've seen with this problem are actually intra-articular bleeding, is more common than you would think. So shifting lameness because they're bleeding into their joints, or classically hematomas at the point of microchipping. So with hemophilia A and B, you'll get a prolonged APTT with normal PT, and then you go on to do individual fracture analysis. With many of these dogs, it's all about prophylactically transfusing them with appropriate factors before you do anything surgical with them. That can have its own problems longer term because you can actually develop inhibitors to deficient factors. Again, to be honest, a lot of these animals will die at birth because of their problem. Excuse me, so that might not always translate into a patient that is clinical. Just in summary, talking about primary and secondary coagulation, as far as the emergency diagnostics for any suspected coagulopathy, we're doing blood smears, we want to look at platelet numbers, we're potentially blood typing sooner rather than later, so we have that information if we have to transfuse. More and more, hopefully, practices are getting PT and APTT benchtop, and that should always be run. The plus or minuses are obviously the BMBT and the Angiostrongylus SNAP or fecal test, depending on which part of the country you're in. Trying to remember to draw samples for instance, individual factor analysis before you do any transfusion is pretty useful. Maybe a little bit of a pain because you're like, well, the last thing I'm thinking about is taking samples for individual factor analysis when my dog is bleeding to death, but it's useful to have those samples. We're using transfusion products in these cases for two reasons. Fundamentally, we're stopping life-threatening bleeding. That bleeding can be very small or very large. You can see significant problems with bleeding because you're having large volumes of blood loss. And in those cases, you may not also, you may not only only be replacing potentially the underlying factor deficiency, you're actually also now having to replace blood volume. With small bleeds in the brain or the lungs, you're going to see significant clinical signs, but these animals are not going to be hypovolemic. They require help with their coagulation, but they don't necessarily need large volumes of blood replacing. As far as the products that are available for replacing clotting factors, we talk about fresh frozen and frozen plasma. Difference between those two things is really how old they are. So fresh frozen plasma is less, excuse me, less than a year old. Contains all the clotting factors and von Willebrand's factor, and can be used for basically any disorder of primary of secondary hemostasis. Frozen plasma is older. So it can be stored up to 5 years. It's cheaper, and will still contain things like the vitamin K dependent clotting factor. So could still be used for those coagulopathies. And actually, if it's your, Joe Bloggs farm dog, non-insured, owners don't have any money, this is a much cheaper option to use for treating those patients. So it's definitely still something to consider. The obtaining of blood products has been made very much easier because of the Pet Blood Bank. They are brilliant at giving advice. They're brilliant at getting products to you quickly. They are generally brilliant. And again, I don't work for the Pet Blood Bank, but I know that they're a great charity, and certainly VetsNow, the company I do work for, supports them, and quite rightly so. These are, I would encourage you that potentially the frozen plasma products, these are things you can have in your practice because you just need a freezer. And again, remember that they can be good for 5 years, so don't worry about wasting money buying things like that. The thing people have more trouble with is storing blood, and obviously it doesn't last as long, so I understand that. But certainly the plasma products are really worth considering. I wanted just to run through a case. It kind of brings the whole sort of information together. Taz is a case that I like to talk about. He's a 13-week-old at this stage, male entire Chihuahua. He has just had his second vaccination and microchip 3 days prior to presentation. He is absolutely teeny tiny. Since that microchip, he's developed an egg-sized lump between his scapulae and has become collapsed at home. So, on examination, he's obtunded. His pulse rate is 240. His heart rate, sorry, is 240. His pulses are weak. His mucous membranes are white. His CRT is 3 seconds. His respiratory rate is 60. So, what one word describes Taz's condition? I can't sadly hear any of you, but I or I see some actually. I see some answers here. And shock is indeed, I can see that better now. Thanks, Nicola, for your comment. And I think shock is exactly what the situation is being described as. I would also say that there may be some rude words you could use to describe this situation. Certainly, panic might be something that you would feel. So, poor wee thing. The initial diagnostics that we ran in this situation was we placed an IV catheter. We got a kind of minimum database of bloods, and I recommend that you can do this with very little blood. So even the blood in the hub of the catheter when you place it would be enough to run some of these parameters. So certainly in any collapsed puppy, blood glucose a must. And actually immediately we see that this is not your typical hypoglycemic chihuahua. Its blood glucose is 4.1. It's not very high, but it's also not low enough to really cause clinical signs. The lactate is high. The PCV is 7. Now we really panic. And the total solids is 40. We tried to get a Doppler blood pressure. I have no idea why, because we knew it was going to be low, but it was unsurprisingly unreadable. So, the next question is, with a PCV of 7 and a total solids of 40, in this case, what would that be most consistent with? I can hear your the clogs in your brain turning. So, I would say that it would be very unusual for a dog to get to a PCV of 7 with anemia of chronic disease. Chronic low-grade hemorrhage, again, can get to these levels, but doesn't usually cause acute collapse like this. And bone marrow disease, again, aside from some of the very acute leukemias, does not really have this kind of typical presentation. Bone marrow disease and chronic low-grade hemorrhage could get you to a PCV of 7, but probably not in the space of a couple of days, and probably not enough to cause you to collapse acutely. Acute hemorrhage, where the PCV is low, the total solids is low, would be the most reasonable explanation for this. Again, with bone marrow disease, the blood cells may be affected, but the total solids is not usually low. If you're allowed to do one more test, what would you prioritize next? So you can have a think about what you would answer. I would say that you could argue potentially for all of them. Full hematology would not be ridiculous. You'd want to understand absolutely what platelets were doing. I think we have a large lump on the back of a dog who's had a microchip. It's safe to potentially presume that that has been bleeding. So assessing coagulation in this way with PT and APTT is not ridiculous either. I suppose. Does this have the hallmarks of a primary hemostatic disorder? I think probably not, as far as there doesn't seem to be any other evidence of bleeding gums and petechiae, etc. So maybe a BMBT would be lower down my list. You could ultrasound the lump, but you could also just feel it and it feels like fluid, or maybe slightly organized blood. But again, it wouldn't be a ridiculous thing to do. So we looked at a blood smear. There were 5 platelets per high power field, so we know that that potentially is not enough to cause spontaneous hemorrhage because of low platelet number. It's not normal. The number is not completely normal, but it wouldn't be at the level that we would consider spontaneous hemorrhage. PT was normal, and APTT was off the scale high. So, based on those results, I'll show you again. What is your most likely diagnosis? DIC. The dog might be in DIC now, but when the bleeding developed, that really wasn't the case. So I think that's unlikely. I mean, who knows? The dog is obviously very poorly just now, so DIC might be a current issue, but not the cause of the bleeding because it's a consumptive coagulopathy. Von Willebrand's disease, I think this does not have so much the hallmarks of a primary hemostatic disorder. And also with von Willebrand's disease, the APTT would be normal. Could the microchip have hit an artery? Under the skin in that region? Probably not. There are some scary stories of microchips being implanted in all sorts of weird and wonderful brain-related places, but I think that's less likely in this case. So it's likely, based on this off-the-scale APTT, that this wee dog has hemophilia A. So what do we do next? All of these things. I think let's not be blindsided by the hemophilia diagnosis. This is a collapsed Chihuahua, and so absolutely my 100% priority would be to deal with the shock, the hypovolemic shock that we think this dog has. And bolusing crystalloids still has to be your priority, regardless of anything else. What this dog needs right now is, excuse me, is volume, and we need to give that back with a crystalloid. We want to be blood typing because clearly he needs blood as well, and we probably do want to be giving blood and or fresh frozen plasma in combination. But I think the priority is the crystalloid fluid bolus. So that's exactly what we did. We bolused 30 mils per kilogram of Hartmann's over 15 minutes. During that bolus, we placed a second IV line because the pressure's improved, and we started defrosting the fresh frozen plasma. We repeated the crystalloid bolus because the blood pressure was still rubbish. Once the fresh frozen plasma was defrosted, we gave a bolus of that. We gave a 10 mil per kilogram over 1 hour. And we also started a packed red blood cell transfusion through the second line. So we're using individual products here. We've got packed red blood cells, we've got fresh frozen plasma in a fridge or in a freezer separate. In the scenario where you have neither of those things, the one thing in this situation that's going to give you blood, clotting factors, everything you need is going to be a whole blood transfusion. So that would be a consideration in this case. So what other blood product would have been appropriate? For this dog, frozen plasma less appropriate because it wouldn't necessarily have all the factors that we would need. We could consider potentially using more defined plasma products. But as far as this scenario, when it's not, you're not just wanting to give the factors, you want to give blood as well, I think whole blood would be appropriate. When it's stored for less than 30 days. So as long as it's not been overly stored and the factors have had time to degrade, then whole blood would have been a consideration here. Cryoprecipitate may be used, excuse me, in these patients to replace some of the clotting factors and potentially prophylactically before surgical procedures. And obviously, platelet-rich plasma would be rubbish because we don't need platelets. He actually did really well. We sent off individual factors and we got the diagnosis of hemophilia A. I sent him away saying that he would do really badly and actually. He did really well, and is leading a relatively normal yet slightly padded life. He's a really cute wee dog. I would start with 10 mils per kilogram of fresh frozen plasma. Clotting factors have quite a short half-life, so you may need to give multiple doses. You don't want to be treating your fresh frozen plasma like this. Squishing it into a freezer, let's not do that. A little waste there, it's not great. Try and keep it in a plastic bag, particularly for defrosting. Don't put it in the microwave because it denatures the proteins. Obviously, you just want a warm bath of water, but not too hot, and it can take some time to defrost. Transfusion-wise, the rule of thumb for transfusion protocols generally is to start slowly. So this mil per kilogram per hour for the first 15 to 20 minutes and then increase. And for blood, certainly, I would give over no more, to be honest, than 4 hours actually. You want to be a wee bit careful with animals that have got cardiac disease. You don't want to volume overload them. You want to be monitoring carefully for reactions. So transfusion reactions typically changes in heart rate. Temperature, respiratory rate. You can see a variety of reactions from tachycardia through to vomiting through to skin reactions. What I normally do, depending on the type of reaction, I will almost always slow the transfusion down, but not stop it abruptly necessarily, unless you're having life-threatening transfusion reactions. And other adjunctive drugs may be things like chlorpheniamine and steroids, depending on the type of reaction. I'll often, if they've had reactions, mild reactions before, I'll often pre-treat with intravenous meropenem, actually, if they're feeling a bit sicky, and that can often help quite nicely. And I would recommend using these standard sheets. So that's the end of the presentation. I hope you found that useful. As I said, maybe mentioned, I work for Vets Now Referrals in Glasgow, and I'm very, very happy for you to email my work address if you have any questions outside the scope of this webinar. And I really do mean that. But if you have any questions now, obviously I'm happy to take them. I apologise about my throat as well. My son is just getting over a hideous chest infection, has kindly passed that on to me. So I apologise.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Scott for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.